It's time now for The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have with us two guests from different perspectives to talk about the top issues in the news this week. From the U.S. Supreme Court upholding the Affordable Care Act's federal subsidies to the stalemate to the logjam over the Wisconsin state budget. And whatever else you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. Steve Prestigard is with us. He is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I just have to correct something quickly in the last news report. I think she said that the state basketball tournament, high school basketball tournament, is next month, which would be a real surprise for basketball coaches and players. I might be a little panicked. It is, of course, in March.
Next month was the maybe we'll have to issue a correction on that. Okay.
next March. Let's agree.
Yeah, maybe it was next March, and you just misunderstood, Steve.
That's possible. It could have been a bad connection on my end.
That you heard Bill Leaders. He is the new associate editor of the Progressive magazine. He's a columnist. He is also the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. And he is making his Week in Review return after a four-year stint as the Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Welcome back, Bill.
It's good to be back.
And congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
In fact, you wrote a piece for Isthmus this week, Bill, that caught my eye on some layoffs at the Wisconsin State Journal. The State Journal announced layoffs of four staffers, including three veteran reporters, and will not fill the gaps left by three departing staff, including investigative reporter Dee Hall and education reporter Dan Simmons. A longtime columnist, Doug Moe, was among the layoffs at the Wisconsin State Journal. What, Bill, was your reaction to hearing that news?
Well, I was very surprised, and I think a lot of people were surprised or shocked to hear that Doug Moe was let go, because he's such an institution in Madison journalism. He's been writing columns for the State Journal since 2008, and before that he was a columnist for the Cap Times. He's written eight books. He was a former editor of Madison Magazine. He's a great journalist, and he's a great columnist. He consistently won the paper's reader survey for favorite reporter, and he was let go. Now, a lot of people over the years have been let go or have accepted buyouts as the operation has shrunk from 80 people editorially, the State Journal, in 2009 to just about 50 people today, and that's put a lot of pain on that operation, a lot of pressure, a lot of pain. The people who remain have to work harder, and I think it's demoralizing to people to know that the more experience that you have, the longer that you've been dedicated to your news organization, the more vulnerable you are, because you get paid slightly more than someone that they can hire right out of college. And so those are the people they target for layoffs, the people with experience, the people who have demonstrated their loyalty and their competence over the years.
Yeah. What about you, Steve Prestigard? What do you think of this?
Well, that was a nice piece of reporting on Bill's part first. I think it's a ridiculous thing to do, you know, to get rid of somebody who is really an institution in Madison journalism and Doug Moe. I've been reading Annie Bagot since I was in middle school. I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that. and, you know, people do not buy newspapers to read management. People buy newspapers to read writers. When you get rid of writers, you are losing your core reason for people to buy the newspaper. You know, you got the city of Madison and Dane County quickly growing. You've got the University of Wisconsin, state government, city of Madison government, which is a universe unto itself. Just by accident, there should be no problem finding news to report. And therefore, if you are actually losing circulation and losing money in a news environment like Madison, then clearly you're doing something wrong. If there were layoffs that needed to take place the suits are the people that should go, and you should have the people who are actually contributing to your product because they are writing things that people buy the newspaper every day and in yearly subscriptions to read. Those are the people you ought to keep, not the, you know, not people with fancy titles who really don't contribute to the product.
I understand. I kind of agree with everything that Steve said. Just so we've said the names, the people who were laid off were Doug Moe and Andy Baggett and Dennis Semro, and also Dan Simmons, the higher education reporter, was officially laid off. I think he
voluntary.
It was more voluntary in his case. And, of course, Dee Hall is gone now, and these people are not going to be replaced. Their books editor, Jeannie Kolker, is gone. And I think Steve is right. The only thing that I hope people don't do in response to things like this is stop reading the paper, because that's just going to put more pressure on things. And they have to know that these organizations are working phenomenally hard. And there's people of extraordinary talent who are committed to doing the best journalism they can in an increasingly difficult environment, and they're doing a great job, and every educated citizen should be reading a newspaper, and the State Journal is a good newspaper still.
Yeah, and I think most listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio still read newspapers, or at least read online the newspaper, but, I mean, is the printed newspaper going away, Bill?
I hope not. It's been a part of my life since I was young enough to read. It was part of my parents' life. It's not part of my kids' life, though. My son doesn't read a print newspaper. His generation has moved away from that. And maybe newspapers can make the transition to the digital age and still find a way to make money and still be relevant. But it is getting harder. And there's several things that happen. One is that it's gotten harder to do the job because there's fewer bodies to do it. But people have risen to that challenge. I think the journalists working today are much more productive, much harder working, and on average, on balance, much more competent and extraordinary than at any other time I can think.
And Steve, what do you think is going to be the future of newspapers?
Well, first off, daily newspapers are not doing well right now, but non-daily newspapers, weekly newspapers, are still doing quite well. One reason is that they have less competition in their markets for news and for advertising and so on. So actually, in the smaller markets, the newspaper is, which is not a daily newspaper, but the newspaper is still doing just fine. The thing you have to remember is that a newspaper is just a delivery product of information. It's printed on paper because they've always been printed on paper. There are other ways to deliver the information, and there may be a day at some future point where you don't see newsprint, ink on newsprint. But as far as the information that is in the newspaper, you know, the fact that it may have a different delivery method at some point doesn't obscure the importance of what the information is. That's what people buy it for. You know, you listen to a radio station that has a news product because of the news product. You watch a TV station, you know, 6 o'clock news, because of the product of news that gets provided on that channel. And people buy a newspaper for the information. You shouldn't get caught up in, well, newspapers are going away because they're not going to be printed. That's not the case at all. You know, you might see a different delivery method, but the information in a newspaper, the depth, the detail, the context that you're able to provide in a newspaper, the need for that information is certainly not going to go away.
Well, we should move on to the news of the week, other news of the week in our Week in Review. And welcome, listeners, if you have an issue in the news this week that you would like to bring up and would like Bill Leaders and Steve Prestigard to discuss, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Wisconsin is still without a budget, even as the July 1st deadline approaches. The new fiscal year starts July 1st, and Wisconsin should have a budget. The Joint Finance Committee has not met since May, and the budget bill is being held up by stalemates on the Milwaukee Bucks arena financing plan and transportation borrowing. just generally at first, and then we'll go into some specifics. Bill Leaders, is this a big deal or not that we don't have a budget yet?
Well, it's inconvenient for Scott Walker because he said he wasn't going to declare that his candidacy for president or whether he's a candidate for president until after the budget was done. And now it looks like that may not happen until after the time that he's set. So he's going to have to readjust his rhetoric to this new reality. I do think that the Bucks Arena is going to be pulled from the budget and dealt with as standalone legislation. From my point of view, I find it baffling why Milwaukee Bucks need a new arena. Didn't they just get one? The Bradley Center was built and opened in 1988. I've never seen a basketball game there. I saw a Prince concert there once. It's a magnificent facility. Why exactly is that no longer a viable sports arena and we have to build a new one at, you know, $500 million? I just think that's crazy. As for the transportation part of it, let's look at what the impasse is about. It's that Governor Walker proposed borrowing $1.3 billion for highway projects, putting it all on the credit card, and that's not a fiscally responsible thing to do. And he's drawn a line in the sand that's saying, I will not raise any fees, I will not have any tax increase, so it's my way or no highway. And I just don't think that's a... I just thought that up, by the way. I don't think that's a responsible thing to do. I think that the state should be looking at reasonable ways to raise more revenue to pay for the projects that we need to do now. It would, if you raised the gasoline tax in Wisconsin by 5 cents a gallon, it would cost the average motorist $30 extra a year. And that would generate $300 million over a 2-year budget period for road projects, a significant amount of money. How is that not a better thing to do than to put this all on the credit card and pay more for it down the line?
We'll get some reaction from Steve on the specifics of gas tax and the Milwaukee Bucks arena. But first, Steve, before our first break, do you think it's a problem that we still don't have a budget?
Well, let me tell you what kind of chaos occurs if Tuesday midnight passes without a new budget. On Wednesday morning, in addition to the sun rising as usual in the east, state spending continues at the previous, at the 2013-15 budget levels until a new budget gets passed. The people who created state governments at statehood were pretty smart in realizing that, you know, there might be political battles and the government should not shut down, as happens in the case of Minnesota and other states, and of course the federal government also, if the budget expires. So that is all that is taking place. And I've noticed some sniping from certain state representatives who seem to forget that I'm pretty sure that the last state budget that Democrats were in charge of, the 2009-2011 state budget, I'm not sure that got done on time. I do know that there were a huge number of budget vetoes by the Democratic governor, Jim Doyle, over the Democrat-created state budget. So this is less a big deal than people think it is. It's interesting to watch the issues come up, transportation funding in the Bucks and so on. But, you know, the budget, state government will continue on Wednesday, whether or not the state budget gets passed or not.
Let me just ask you briefly, Steve. Walker announcing his plans for 2016 by July 13th, or he says he will announce on July 13th his plans.
The week of.
Is this going to put a crimp in that plan?
Well, it might. I mean, it's... I can guarantee you that the 2015-17 state budget is not going to be a campaign issue for president, but I suppose if he, I guess it comes down to the question of what's your definition of week of? Does that go from Monday to Friday the 17th? Is it 17th? Does that go from Monday to Sunday, or, you know, how far do you want to stretch it? But it's really a minor issue to me, at least.
I don't think that the
the budget is going to affect the governor's plans for when he announces for president. But I think the governor's plans for when he announces for president may affect the budget. If there's not enough time left in the window that he's left himself, there maybe won't be enough time for him to do the thorough review that he should be doing to decide what parts of the budget to veto, and maybe some things that get crammed in at the last minute, as they always do, are going to make it into law when they should have been filtered out.
Let me take a short break, and then we will continue talking about some of these state budget issues, including the transportation budget and the logjam over the Milwaukee Bucks arena. And we'll welcome your thoughts, your questions, and the topics from the news this week that you want to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guests this week on The Week in Review, Bill Leaders, new associate editor of the Progressive magazine, and Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top news stories of the week. We are talking with Steve Prestigard and Bill Leaders today, and you too, if you'd like to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, one of the owners of the Milwaukee Bucks says the clock is running down on reaching a deal for a new downtown Milwaukee arena, and says that a deal needs to be reached soon, and like very soon, and that he also said owners should not be paying more than they already are for the project. Steve, what do you say to that?
Well, I go back and forth on the whole subject of the Bucks, I guess. You know, the contribution from both the Bucks owners and Herb Cole is approximately half of the cost of the project, which is a bigger contribution than in a lot of cases. And City of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee County are finally ponying up, or at least willing to pony up. As far as the Bradley Center, I would suggest, Bill, you really should go to a game at some point, and particularly sit in like the end zone seats on the lower bowl or upstairs, where you know you feel like if you lean forward, you're going to fall out of your seat. The Bradley Center, yes, it was built in 1988. That now makes it the second oldest arena in the National Basketball Association. And I can tell you for a fact that when you have at least two communities that want to get NBA teams that don't have them, Seattle used to have the Supersonics, now they're gone. Kansas City used to have the Kings, now they're in Sacramento. It's analogous to Los Angeles of the National Football League. The longer those communities don't have NBA teams, the more it is putting pressure on locals to upgrade their arenas where necessary, or else they're going to lose the team. And there is a provision in the Bucks sale that to the new owners that says if they don't get a new arena, they can sell it back to the NBA. They would make money, and the franchise would leave Milwaukee. And maybe you don't like professional basketball. Maybe I'm not a fan of it. Maybe most of the readers aren't. But there are a fair number of jobs at the Bradley Center. Not the players, but, you know, people who put the hockey floor in and take it out, and people who collect tickets and so on, that probably won't have jobs if the Bucks leave.
Yeah, the Seattle Bucks, Bill.
Well, you know, one of the mechanisms for raising money for a sports team is to charge the fans who go to the games. You can increase the ticket price in order to raise that revenue. Maybe the people who do go to the games should bear the brunt of this cost and not everybody. You know, I'm 5'6". I hate basketball. Basketball's been the source of some of the most terrible moments of my life. When I was in sixth grade, we lost to St. Roberts by a score of 78-0. My coach at the time was Joe Zarneski, who's now the county clerk of Milwaukee. And basketball is not a thing for me. And I don't know that every citizen in the state needs to participate in the buying of another stadium for a sports franchise that makes millions upon millions of dollars and has fans that can foot the bill.
Let's take a call from Patrick in Greenfield. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am very opposed to this new stadium on several grounds. But the biggest thing that gets me is, how come we could not have high-speed rail, which is about the same cost that's being batted around as the proposed Buck Stadium? However, the Buck Stadium we must have, because if we don't have the Buck Stadium, we're going to fall apart. I mean, this is just nonsense. If there was as much money in this proposal for the participants to make money, then there wouldn't be any need for public funding. They would have private enterprise falling all over themselves trying to get in on the deal. But this is the problem. This is a big smoke and mirrors project. There is not any substance here. This is just funding a luxury palace for millionaires and billionaires to have their game of basketball in. And it's really the wrong way of thinking. If we want to revitalize America, if we want to revitalize our economy, we have to get back to the nuts and bolts of how you do things, not extravagant things such as professional sports.
Thank you, Patrick. Well, Steve Pressegard, what about why should taxpayers subsidize this arena for the billionaire owners of the Bucks?
Because if they didn't, somebody else would. And it's unfortunate to say that, but I believe I can probably count on one hand the number of completely privately financed sports arenas, none of which are in the NBA. The two that come to mind are the San Francisco Giants ballpark and Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. There may be others, but those are the only two that come to mind. But again, remember what we're talking about here. We're talking about the possibility of the Bucks leaving Milwaukee. And Bill might be old enough to remember what happened when the Milwaukee Braves left for Atlanta. That was the year I was born. So, but among other things, a lot of politicians, including the governor and the chief justice of the state Supreme Court, lost their jobs as a result of the Bucks leaving for Atlanta. And, you know, I hate to put things in such crass... Sorry, Braves, you're right. And I'm sorry to put this in such crass political terms, but I'm sure that's probably in Scott Walker's mind and the mind of some other state representatives either, that they don't want to be the ones who were around when the Bucks left.
A Democratic state lawmaker who met with Governor Scott Walker on Thursday said that the likely presidential candidate told him he needs Democratic votes to pass his funding package for the Milwaukee Bucks Arena. And Jorgensen says Walker told him he is considering vetoing a long list of items that Republicans have inserted into the budget. A spokesperson for Walker denied that he made the comments on vetoes, but Jorgensen stood by what he said. Jorgensen is quoted as saying to the governor, "Are you going to need Democratic votes to get this Bucks deal passed?" The governor said, "Yes." Jorgensen said, "Beyond the city limits of Milwaukee?" Again, Walker said, "Yes." What do you think of that, Steve?
I don't think it's a surprise that all you have to do is read the newspaper to see that Republicans are divided on this. There are people in the Republican Party who believe that taxpayer money shouldn't be spent on sports arenas, even though in this particular case, at $80 million, that's not a huge amount of money for individual state taxpayers. There are Republicans, you know, who realize that the Bucks leaving Milwaukee, even though they are certainly not as statewide a team as the Packers or even the Milwaukee Brewers, they realize that the Bucks leaving would be a bad thing. And I think it's a little weird to be criticizing Scott Walker or any governor for trying to be bipartisan. The Democrats, it seems to me, have been trying to have this both ways, where they're going to oppose a stadium deal, and then if the stadium deal doesn't pass and the Bucks leave, they'll say, it was Scott Walker's fault and Republicans' fault that the Bucks left Milwaukee.
Well, I think what they're saying is that if you want our support on the Bucks arena, you know, will you listen to us about the concerns we have about other parts of this budget that we don't like and that we think you should veto. I don't know that there's anything wrong with looking at it that way. I'll grant that Steve has a better grasp of the economics of the situation and how national teams, the situation nationally and the prospect of the Bucks leaving. And I hope the Bucks do stay as a basketball team, but I don't feel that the public needs to be a primary source of funding for a new sports palace.
Let's move on to another budget issue, the transportation budget. Assembly Republicans argued this week that road projects outside Milwaukee should be prioritized if money is cut back from Walker's proposed borrowing. But the governor and the Senate Republicans say the Zoo interchange should not be delayed under any plan. What should happen with transportation, Bill?
Well, there's $1.3 billion of highway projects that the governor wanted to borrow for, and the legislature said that's about $800,000 too much. So they're talking about borrowing $800 million too much. They're talking about borrowing $500 million, and that means doing less than half of the projects or less than half of the cost that was originally proposed. So there's got to be cut somewhere. And if you do the Zoo interchange, still a high priority project, there's not going to be money left for other projects in other parts of the state. And so logically, the lawmakers from those communities are concerned about their communities bearing the brunt of the state's inability to come up with the money that it needs for the projects it's identified. I think the key, again, is to find sources of revenue to pay for these projects in real time. I don't know what is so horrible about a $10 increase in the vehicle registration fee, which in Wisconsin is very low. I don't know what's so horrible about a 5 cent per gallon increase in the state's gasoline tax, which hasn't been increased in many years, and that would help generate revenue for roads from the people who use them.
Yeah, what about those options, Steve?
Well, real quick, Bill, about the Bucks. Don't feel bad about not being able to play basketball at 5'6". I'm 6'4", and I couldn't play basketball either.
Oh, so good. That makes me feel
as
better.
As far as this goes, one thing that I hear Republicans say about the transportation budget is that they feel that it's not being spent in the right areas in some cases. I don't dislike roundabouts, but it seems as though every roundabout or every road project includes roundabouts, whether they're really needed or not. Those are more expensive to install than a standard intersection. Frankly, there are other issues with gas tax revenues being spent for things that are not primarily benefiting drivers and haulers of freight on the roads. Now, having said that, when you have a guy who is, you got a no tax increase pledge out there, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult to get around that. The other issue is that it is possible that gas taxes are not on the way out as far as a funding source, certainly. But let's remember, everybody who has a car is driving a car that gets considerably better gas mileage than they used to. That includes particularly, owners of electric cars and hybrids who, really hardly pay anything for gas. Therefore, they really don't contribute very much as far as gas tax revenues go. Having said that, there's also the issue of the fact that when you have an increase in, vehicle registration fees are, by the liberals' term, regressive, because everybody pays the same whether they have a new car or a 20-year-old car or whatever. So it's a little bit more complicated than all of this is. It's sure going to be fun to watch because you have people who are going to be, kind of on the record as far as increasing a fee instead of a tax, or increasing a tax instead of a fee, or spending money or borrowing money and increasing the state's debt load, even though it is still a very favorable interest rate environment for borrowing.
Let's take a call from Jerry in Waukesha on the gas tax. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I wanted to say, to me, the reason why they're resisting fuel tax increase is I'm sure the any business that owns a vehicle, especially trucking, is lobbying to keep that from happening because they don't want to raise their costs, keep their costs low. And this I've been a professional mechanic for 40 years. This business of their vehicles are more fuel efficient, and that's going to, we're not going to get as much revenue. To me, I would say that's bunk because as some cars are more efficient, more people own pickup trucks and SUVs who don't get any better mileage than vehicles did back in the 60s and 70s. Plus, this state is filled with snowmobiles, boats, ATVs, motorcycles, lawnmowers, anything that runs on gasoline, whether it's used on the highway or not, will contribute to that fuel tax revenue. Yeah. And I think this is just another way to conceal a break for businesses and put it on the back of the working folks and the ordinary citizens, and this way they can conceal another profit for businesses.
Bill?
Well, caller, do you think that the state should increase its gasoline tax and raise the revenue that way, or you think that the big businesses just decided to block that from happening because it would cost
it more? The caller dropped off. Oh. He was too afraid to answer your question.
Well, I still think that a small increase in the state gasoline tax is doable and it's responsible. And I, you know, as someone who doesn't like the idea of using my credit card and ringing up huge amounts of debt, I don't think the state should do that either. Projects that it has identified a need for. If it needs it, it should do them, and it should pay for them, the way other people do.
Yeah. The trucking industry lobbyists, he says, our caller said, Steve, will stop a gas tax increase from going into effect. There was a story also this week that with the budget at the stalemate that it's in, that the lobbyists are probably having a field day trying to get as much as they can put into this state budget. How big a part are the lobbyists playing?
Well, obviously they are, because that's the way the system works. That is the way the system has worked in every state budget probably in the history of the state. As far as what the caller said, he said about one thing that was accurate and then about 10 things that were not. He seems to think that, that apparently from what I heard, profit is a bad thing. I hate to tell this person this, and it's kind of too bad he didn't pay attention to how his business was run, whether he runs it or he works for somebody. When you haul products, the cost of hauling the products is part of the product price. So when you increase fuel taxes, that increases the cost of the product. And guess who gets to pay then? Oh, yes, consumers. To think that that businesses will just cheerfully swallow up a gas tax increase that makes shipping their products more expensive, but hey, we're not going to charge more, that's a really naive statement. So it would be helpful to keep that in mind, that if you're talking about increasing the gas perhaps the gas tax as much as the diesel fuel tax, you're going to increase product cost, and the result of increasing product cost is going to be increasing the cost that consumers pay for goods and services, because businesses, number one, first and foremost, have to make money.
Nominally, though, the cost increase that you're talking about from a small increase in the gasoline tax is nominal. If we raise it 5 cents a gallon, we're talking about a 2% increase in the gas tax. If you now pay $1,500 on gasoline a year, which would be the average Wisconsin motorist, you'd be paying $1,530. This isn't such a huge amount that every product is going to skyrocket in price if the state of Wisconsin increases its gas tax slightly.
We have to take a break. We're way past break time. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking this week with Bill Leaders, the new associate editor of the Progressive Magazine, and Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. We'll talk more about top stories of the week, including Governor Walker signing some new gun rights bills into law after we return. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, where we review the top stories in the news each week. We are talking with two guests from different perspectives, Steve Prestigard and Bill Leaders. Let's talk about a couple more items, including the legislative committee that handles state workers' contracts approved a 3% raise on Tuesday for state troopers, but other state employees will receive no increases over the next 2 years. Troopers were exempt from the 2011 law ending collective bargaining. They also have not received a raise since 2009. So zero raise for state workers, but a 3% raise for state troopers. What do you think of that, Bill?
Well, you know, originally they were talking about something like a 17% raise for the state troopers. This raise is smaller than that, and it's probably more in line with inflationary costs. But, you know, the rest of the state workforce has inflationary costs, too, and they haven't had a raise, and they're not going to get a raise for in the next biennium. I think that's a little unfortunate. I think it matters that we have good, qualified people in state government, and they do have other options if the pay is too poor, and they have lost much of the advantage that they once had in terms of the benefit package. So, you know, if we're not going to pay people a reasonable amount in a market where there are other options for them, we're going to lose good help, and it's not going to be a good thing for the state.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
Well, I read a state employee on Facebook complaining about this, and her claim was that the median salary of a state employee is $44,000. According to the U.S. Census, the median family income in this state is about $53,000. So, a state employee in the middle in terms of pay makes as much money by himself or herself as almost as much as a median family does in this state. So they're doing pretty well still as far as not only their pay, but they certainly have much better benefits than people who work in the private sector. And they are still, even after Act 10, paying less for those benefits in the private sector. I have to say that I am not a fan of the State Patrol as an organization, but I guess the thing I would point out is that the State Patrol probably are the only state employees who go to work with the realization that they might not come back home at the end of the day. So maybe they are more deserving, I guess, in this line of thought, according to
not
the governor,
the
pay raises than the rest.
Not the only. There are police officers. There are firefighters. There are other public service employees that
I'm sorry,
at risk
state
their lives.
Government bill. State employees.
Okay.
All right. Well,
I know what you're talking about.
Now, On Point will have much more on this after 9 o'clock, but let me get you both to briefly react to the U.S. Supreme Court upholding the federal subsidies in President Obama's Affordable Care Act, which means 183,000 Wisconsin residents who buy their health insurance through the federal exchanges will continue to be able to do so or get the subsidies anyway. Good decision, Bill, or not?
Well, I think we dodged a bullet. You know, if the U.S. Supreme Court had decided to break the Affordable Care Act, as some people wanted it to do, it would have been up to Congress to fix it. Is there anyone that doesn't find that terrifying?
Steve?
I guess in a sense Bill is right, because what this does do, regardless of the merits or lack thereof of the decision, is it certainly does force Congress to come up with a better alternative than Obamacare is. The fact is that the Republicans in Congress were hoping for the Supreme Court to overturn it, but they didn't get their hope. Now they actually have to exhibit some political courage. It certainly also, it should be pointed out, bails out. It's actually perfect for Scott Walker because there is no huge hole in the state budget created by losing the subsidies, but at the same time, assuming he's running for president, he can say that he is against Obamacare, as he said he is, and he can do the harder thing, which is to come up with a better alternative that actually improves health care and health insurance for everybody and not improve health insurance for the uncovered by making health insurance worse for the people who have coverage.
I think after, you know, however many years and however many dozens of attempts there have been to repeal Obamacare, we have to get beyond letting politicians say, as Scott Walker did in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's ruling, that we need to repeal Obamacare. The question that needs to be put back at them when they say that, and replace it with what? What is your plan? How would you take care of these 10 million people who are now getting health care coverage through this federal program?
Let's move on to another issue. Governor Walker signed into law a bill that ends the 48-hour handgun purchase waiting period, and also a bill that allows retired police officers to carry guns on school property. He said that the signings were scheduled prior to the shooting in Charleston, and that pulling back the ceremony would have given people the impression that the two laws had anything to do with what happened in Charleston. Steve Prestigard, was he right?
Well, it certainly was in the works well before the Charleston shootings. The other thing that needs to be pointed out is that this changes less than people think it does, because the state is required to do a background check if there's not an instant background check available. The state is required to do a background check within 5 business days. So the 48-hour waiting period doesn't really change that. And the fact is that there is no legitimate reason. If somebody passes a background check, there's really not a legitimate reason to deny him or her the firearm that this person wants to purchase.
Well, it's the cooling off period rationale, and that's why this change was opposed uniformly by domestic violence groups who are trying to prevent the ability of someone to quickly obtain a handgun to kill a spouse.
You know, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says that if we don't need this 48-hour waiting period, then apply this to private gun sales too, Steve Prestigard. Do an instant background check when it comes to private gun sales.
Private gun sales are not the problem in this particular case. And, you know, if you look at the number of crimes taking place in Milwaukee, for instance, they are guns that have been stolen. They are guns also that have been illegitimately gotten. That's private gun sales are not the problem.
Sometimes they are, and there would be a certain number of sales that would be stopped if the background check rule applied to private gun sales. Which in practice would work that if you wanted to sell a gun to private individual to private individual, you have to involve a gun shop, which will do the background check before that sale can go forward, and there would be some sales that would be stopped, and there would be some lives that would be saved. And background checks are supported by upwards of 80% of the Wisconsin public, 90% of the Wisconsin public, including Republicans by overwhelming margins, including National Rifle Association members support this overwhelmingly, and it's considered politically dead on arrival. Why is that? How can that sensible change in the law have no chance of passage, and then we've got people running around saying, oh yeah, we really have to have more guns in schools, so, you know, let's pass that. We really can't abide by a 48-hour wait before someone can walk out of a gun shop with a gun. I just think that's moving in the wrong direction. I think the governor's plan should have been changed by what happened in Charleston.
Here's a new topic from a listener, but related topic. A listener says, please comment on Governor Walker's stance on the Confederate flag. At first he said it should be a state's rights choice, then a day or two later he changed his mind. Well, he said actually after South Carolina, Governor Nikki Haley said that South Carolina should remove its Confederate flag from statehouse grounds, that he agreed with Governor Haley. So your quick take on that, Bill.
Well, you know, he had his finger in the air on this one. You know, where are the winds blowing? He didn't want to commit himself to a course of action until, you know, it was the politically smart thing to do. Jeb Bush, on the other hand, said when asked about the Confederate flag that in Florida they put their Confederate flag where it belonged, in the museum. You know, not everyone ducked this issue.
Steve.
I don't think the two statements Walker made are incompatible, because he said it's the issue for South Carolina to decide, which it is, along with all of the states in the South that have parts of Confederate flags in their own state flags. And then he said he supported Governor Haley's decision. And I don't see those to be incompatible statements. I certainly hope that Bill doesn't and other people don't support this ridiculous whitewashing of part of our history that is taking place. I mean, it's one thing to remove a Confederate flag from a state capitol, particularly when it was put there by Democrats, but you have such idiocy going on right now. It's Warner Brothers announcing they're taking the Confederate Navy Jack off the top of the General Lee for Dukes of Hazzard toys. And you have people saying that there should be that the names of Confederate veterans should be taken off of military bases in the South. That's just stupid. Who should support that?
It's time now for our Week in Review quiz, and here is our quiz question. A fun new invasive species was first reported in the state 2 years ago. Now observers are finding that it is spreading steadily across Wisconsin with the potential to cause substantial damage to native plants. What is this invasive species? 1-800-642-1234. Call in if you know or if you'd like to guess. If you are correct, we will send you an iHeart WPR magnet. What is this new invasive species that is spreading across Wisconsin, scaring some people and potentially damaging native plants in Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We have some callers who want to try. Joan in Eau Claire. Hi, Joan. What is this new invasive species?
Hi, good morning. The jumping worm.
You are correct. The jumping worm. And this is really hideous. If you see videos of it, we'll put a video up on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. The jumping worm was first found in Wisconsin in October of 2013. Now they are being found all over the state. DNR officials are taking steps to try to slow the spread this summer. They are more active and aggressive than other worms. They consume the layer of leaves and other organic matter on top of the soil faster than other earthworm species. When the soil is exposed, an infested area is prone to erosion and runoff, and that's a part of the worry. So have you seen a jumping worm, Bill?
I have not. Maybe I will.
Yeah. Steve, I take it you don't have jumping worms in your backyard?
They better not get anywhere near my roses, or else there's going to be major death occurring among the worms. I do think this is an obvious Sci-Fi Channel movie coming up, by the way. Flying worms? Okay.
Yeah. We will be talking with a DNR expert about jumping worms, and I understand he's going to bring some into the studio on Monday morning at 6 o'clock, so I can hardly wait for that. We still have a moment or two, and I wanted to ask you, Bill, first, Bernie Sanders is coming to Madison.
Saw that.
Is Bernie Sanders, does he have a good shot at challenging Hillary Clinton for
he'll raise issues that won't otherwise get raised. He may affect the tenor of the race. He's someone with a long political career and who commands a lot of respect, and there will be interest in what he has to say when he comes to Madison next week, right? I think it's good that there's some other people in the race besides Hillary Clinton, and we should listen to what they have to say.
Yeah, July 3rd is his date to be in Madison. Quick comment on Bernie Sanders, Steve?
Well, he's perfect for Madison. I won't be going to that to work, but, if you think that having, what is the count now, 16, 25 Republican presidential candidates. We should have more Democratic candidates. Jim Webb, a actual non-liberal Democrat from Virginia, he should get in the race. Martin O'Malley apparently is in the race. Not sure why, but let's have candidate chaos, I guess.
Yeah, and we will we'll eventually be inviting all of the presidential candidates to be on Wisconsin Public Radio, and they can choose to accept or not. We will put out an invite to see if Bernie Sanders wants to join us. Thanks very much, Steve Prestigard and Bill Leaders, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Bill Leaders.
I'm going to go out and look for worms.
Listen on Monday morning. You'll learn more about them. Bill Leaders, a new associate editor at the Progressive Magazine, and Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Thanks to Christy Taylor, Bill Martins, and Caleb Lato for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.